I don't know how you are. I'm a very inquisitive person. I like to ask questions. Anybody that comes and does work at my house, I ask them lots of questions. I'm just inquisitive. People are working on my car. I have to ask. I just like to know how stuff works and stuff. So when I read my Bible, I ask lots of questions. I don't. Do you? Yeah, I do. And some of them, I'm like, I don't know if I can find out the answer to that question. So I want to just share with you some of my questions that I have on my mind that I would like an answer to these sometime. It would be kind of fun. I don't know if I'll remember these when I get to heaven of the long list that I have, but here's a few. You have your own, right? Yeah. So do you think that Eve ever ate another piece of fruit? And I was like, I'm not doing that again. How about the Noahic flood? I wonder after the Noahic flood if Noah really liked boats after that. Or he's like, oh, PTSD, I can't get in another one of those things. I don't know. And then just, you know, the staff of Moses, like the coolest thing ever. Like, what happened to that thing? Like, you would think that they would have that relic and they would just, like, preserve it as his staff, but I have no idea. And then that leads kind of the Ten Commandments. I don't know if you saw Cecil B. DeMille's movie last night. They show it every Passover. You didn't see it? Serious, what were you doing last night? Or you were getting ready for here, for Easter? Oh, spiritual church. Well, I watched some of it because I love it. But, you know, when God's finger comes and carves into the stone, the Ten Commandments, it was stone. I mean, stone doesn't go anywhere. So it's like, well, where are those things? Wouldn't it be cool if like they just like appeared one day? I mean, but I would like to know where they are. How about Jonah? Do you think that Jonah, after his ordeal, liked fish after that? I'm just, I don't know. And then thinking about Samson. Samson, I mean, we know his strength came from the Holy Spirit, but I mean, he had to have some muscle tone, right? So as a guy that used to lift weights all the time when I played sports, it's like, okay, he either had ripped muscle or bulk muscle. I went, like, what was it? Was he like a big lineman, just bulk muscle, or was he ripped like a Schwarzenegger at the prime? I mean, which was it? You're probably thinking, these are your questions? Yeah. King David, he wrote much of the Psalter, as you know, and his instrument of choice? Lyre. Yeah, like a harp. Yeah, yeah, like a Stratocaster, like on our version of that. Electric guitar type thing. We know he could play that. We know he could write music, but I like, could he sing? I mean, like on pitch. Now, if you're a person that can sing in pitch on the right key and you're singing by somebody that's not, that thinks they are, you're like, whoa, dude, I need to pray for you. I mean, I came from a family of professional singers. My sisters both sang out of Nashville, 100,000 miles a year. They traveled doing concerts with Andre Crouch. I think they did some Billy Graham Crusades, 700 Club, those kind of sisters. They could sing. I mean, they could bring it. Both of them could. So when I'm near somebody that's like off pitch, it's like, ooh, it's painful. So I just want to know. I mean, David was good at writing music and he was good on the lyre. I wonder what his voice was like. You know, I want to ask him when I see him. What are your questions? You have questions? Now, I have deeper theological questions, of course. But one question that I entertained this week, which I found the answer to after I posed it. Of all the women in the New Testament that are spoken about, who's spoken about the most of any woman in the entire New Testament? We play Bible trivia here. Do you know? There's lots of Marys. Which Mary? Mary, which one? No, not Mother Mary. No, you're wrong. Sorry. Mary Magdalene is spoken about the most. And Magdalene is not her last name. Okay? So I'll show you this chart. It's a map. What would be a service be in a military community without a map? Right? So this is our map, and this is the Sea of Capernaum on the north shore where Jesus did his base operations. That's where Peter's fishing. It's where he lived, and then that's where his fishing operations were based out of because he had multiple boats. And if you went down the coastline heading toward Tiberias, you ran into the city of Magdala, and she was Mary from Magdala. So this would be equivalent to Debbie from Dumfries. Well, that's not really her last name, right? No, she's just from Dumfries. Yeah. So whenever they said Mary, since there were so many Marys, as you just showed here on the front row, Ken, you said just Mary. Well, that could be like a whole bunch of Marys. But if you said Mary like your wife did, Mary Magdalene, you know. Well, that's that Mary from the city of Magdala. That was her. That leads to another question. She's the most spoken about woman in the entire New Testament. It leads to a second question. Who was the first person that Jesus appeared to in his resurrected body? Okay, I'm going to say it wasn't Peter. It wasn't John. It wasn't Joseph of Arimathea. It wasn't Nicodemus. It was Mary. Which one? That lady from Dumfries. No, the lady from Magdala. That lady. That's who. Leads to another question, and I've been asking these questions all week as I was studying. It's like, this question leads to this question, leads to this question. Okay, so if he appeared to her first, that leads to a why question. Why her? Why did he appear to her first? I mean, I can think of a whole bunch of other people I think would be a little more important if you're trying to substantiate the resurrection. You know, like Peter. Appear to Peter first. Why? Well, he's like the el jefe of the disciples, right? He's like, do you know Spanish? Yeah, he's like the main man. He's like the leader. Or he didn't appear to him. Well, why didn't he appear to James and John? Well, they have issues. What were their issues? They were known as, their nickname was Sons of Thunder. Why? Because they had anger management issues. So the disciples, some of them had issues. They did. So Jesus appears first to Mary from what city, Ken? Magdala. Thank you so much. You're coming along, dude. So why in the world did Jesus appear to Mary first? Okay, so I'm going to answer that question this morning because I think the answer to that question will challenge you spiritually if you're a Christian, and it will also challenge you spiritually if you're not a Christian. And her testimony is an amazing one. So we want to look at the question, why did Jesus appear to Mary first? Three answers. One, she is what I would call a perpetual disciple. And thinking minds, because we have a church full of them here, want to know, okay, wait a minute. Okay, you say she's a perpetual disciple. What about Peter? I mean, wasn't he a perpetual disciple? Well, he was to a point. Then he had his moments, didn't he? Like when Christ is arrested and he's kind of hanging around and they're asking him, hey, aren't you the Galilean? Not me. I never met the man. So he kind of left the reservation. So he wasn't a perpetual disciple. He had his moment. So his spiritual walk is probably something similar to yours. Like a Richter scale. Like I'm following hard after Jesus. Oh man, I totally blew it. I'm a hard follower. Yeah. Nope, I totally blew it. And that's kind of how your spiritual walk goes. I mean, who has one that goes straight to glory? Well, Peter had issues. We know there was 12 disciples. Judas is out as a perpetual disciple just because by definition who Judas is. So that leaves us with 11 other disciples, but some of them had issues. And so when Christ picks a person to appear to, he appears to Mary because the other disciples, the other 10 of them had, or the 11 of them had deserted him. Matthew 26:56 says they ran for cover. When they arrested Christ, they all took off. Later, John comes back, finds Mary, gets down to the cross, has a moment of courage, and stands there by the cross with Mary, the mother of Jesus. So we know he came back, but he too had his moment of running for cover. But there was one person that never ran from Christ. It was a woman. Her name was Mary. Luke 8 talks about her. She was straight as an arrow. You could count on this woman. It says in Luke 8, verse 1, toward the beginning of Christ's ministry, these words. Soon afterwards, he, Jesus, began going around from one city and village to another. What was he doing? Proclaiming and preaching about the kingdom of God. And the 12 were with him, and also some women who had been healed of two things, evil spirits, so demonic possession, and sicknesses, which is probably brought on by demonic possession. Mary, who was called Magdalene, was one of them, from whom seven demons had gone out, and Jonah, the wife of Cusa, Herod's steward, and Susanna, and many others who were contributing to their support out of their private means. So there was an entourage of women that followed Jesus. Now, this might blow your whole worldview of how you think about the disciples, that it was just 12 men following Jesus wherever he went. Not so. You had Jesus with 12 men going and doing the ministry and preaching, and you also had a huge entourage of women. And the list who some of the women were, and Christ had led these women to salvation, and they used their financial means to support what he did. Isn't that amazing? Doesn't say the men were doing it. The women were supporting what the men were doing. This is interesting. So we don't know the exact circumstances of Mary from Magdala, her salvation, how she got saved. We just know that she did get saved. So when religious leaders would mock Christ and it was dangerous to be near Christ, she never deserted him. When the 70 disciples, according to the book of John, left Jesus because they found his teachings way too stringent, she didn't go anywhere. In fact, it tells us at the crucifixion that she also followed Jesus from Galilee all the way down to Jerusalem. It says in chapter 27 of Matthew, verse 55, many women were there looking on from a distance at the crucifixion of Christ, who had followed Jesus from where? Galilee in the north, while ministering to him. Among them was Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. So she had followed Christ with an entourage of women who were ardent disciples of Christ, along with the other disciples, all the way down to Jerusalem. So why did Jesus pick her? Well, she was a perpetual disciple that never left the reservation. When many others were prone to leaving the reservation and coming back, you could always count on her. So he's going to entrust the message of his resurrection, the greatest message ever known to mankind, he's going to entrust it to somebody. So who's he pick? He picks someone he knows he can count on. And who's that? Well, it's Mary. It's Mary. That's who he picks. Leads to another question. If that's the criteria that he's going to use to pick her, would he pick you? Would he have picked you? Would he pick me? Would your walk with him be so tight, so intimate, that when Jesus says, I want to announce my resurrection, and I want you to be the first one to do it, would he choose you? He chose her. And she will become the first evangelist of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, Mary. He chose her because she's a perpetual disciple. Two, he chose her because she's a picture of mercy. Chapter 8 of Luke that we just talked about said that he had delivered her from how many demons? Seven. Mark, parallel account, says in chapter 16, verse 9. Now, after he had risen early on the first day of the week, which was Sunday, because Shabbat on their calendar was on the Saturday, first day of the week, he first appeared to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out seven demons. So it tells you two times that Mary Magdalene had seven demons. Well, this is interesting. So Christ picks her because she's a perpetual disciple. Now he's going to pick her because she's a person of mercy. He showed mercy to a woman controlled by demonic beings. Oh, you want to use her as your first witness? Christ says, absolutely. Now think about what this means, because it says it twice that she had seven demons. We don't know how she contracted them. Did she dabble in the black arts? Did she do Ouija boards, their equivalent of that? I mean, what did she do? We don't know. We don't know when it happened, but we know that it did happen. And we know that the gospel writers tell us that demons have the ability to inhabit a human and get them to do things they wouldn't normally do. And so when you think about Mary, she had seven demons, but that's not anything close to what the demoniac had in the area, the Gerasenes area. So it would be the south eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee. Luke 8 talks about them because Christ ran into this man in the tombs, and he's absolutely superhuman strength. He's crazy in his strength. And everybody was scared to death of the man, and Christ runs into him, and he realizes that the guy has a demon. So Jesus, the Lord of glory, who created angelic beings, ask the demon his name. And the demon says, my name is Legion, because we are many. When you know how a Roman military unit is put together, a legion is composed of 5,000 to 6,000 soldiers. So what did Legion just tell Jesus to his face? Oh, I'm not alone. There's 5,000 of my buddies with me in this one guy. And you're sitting there thinking in your scientific mind, no, wait a minute. How do you get these non-spatial, trans-dimensional beings to inhabit like that? Well, in their transdimensional world, they can do things that defy our laws of physics. And so Legion's telling you, I've got a lot of backup buddies with me. Now, we know the story because God's going to deal with Legion. But the point being, she has seven demons. Seven demons. Seven is the number in the Bible of perfection, right? And so six is the number of men. Seven is the number of God. It's the number of perfection. So what he's telling you is she's the perfect model of a person that doesn't know God. Mary, that's who she is. A person that was demon-possessed in the Gospels, if you read through the Gospels, because when Christ showed up on the planet, we know from Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 to 2, that the devil is the prince and power of the air of this cosmos. We know from Job chapter 1 that the devil walks back and forth between earth and the throne room of God to bring accusation against believers. That's what he does. But when he inhabits a person, they evidence unusual strength. They have alteration of the voice that another voice spoke. Like when Christ spoke to Legion, it's Legion he's speaking to, not the man in question. A lot of times the miracles that Christ did with people that were possessed, they were blind, they were mute, there was deafness, convulsions, etc. When Christ comes down from the Mount of Transfiguration, he runs into a father and his son, and the father begs Christ to help him because a demon possesses his boy and throws him into the fire all the time. And Christ helps that little boy find redemption by getting rid of his demonic problem. And so if you take that and apply it to Mary, who has seven demons, you can surmise that she didn't have very many friends. She probably had no life. She probably had a hard time keeping a job. She probably had some kind of physical malady that she couldn't shake. And you could go on down the list. She's in a hopeless state of despair. She's dominated by the dark side. And then one day she ran into Christ. And what did he do? Well, with a word, he changed her life dramatically because he excised all seven of them with a word. And no longer was she a follower of the devil. Now she's a follower of Christ. Now she's free for the first time in many, many years. Why did Christ pick her? What was the first reason why he chose her to be his witness? What was the first reason? She was a perpetual what? Disciple. Yeah. The second one is what? She's a picture of mercy because she's a picture of a person that doesn't know God and can't save themselves. They need help from on high. That's Christ. And so he redeems her. What does it mean to you? If you're not a Christian today, well, then you are locked into sin, whether you like it or not. You're born that way. And the only way that you can find salvation and freedom and victory is to know this is a Savior, Christ. He can free you. Third reason he chose her, and the last reason, is she's a powerful witness. So he chose her for the fact she's a perpetual disciple. Second point, we test here at our church, by the way. I know you can't say it's early in the morning because we've been here doing this now three times. So first service, I cut him some slack, okay? Second reason why he chose her was picture of absolutely perfect mercy. Third one is powerful witness. So if you wanted to build a case that Christ rose from the grave, in their Semitic culture, you would not have picked a woman to be the first witness. Why? Well, because in the Semitic culture, they look down upon women. How do I know that? Well, because I've read the Talmud. What did the Talmud say? Listen to how the typical Semitic mind thought about a woman at this day and time. Talmud, Sotah, chapter 19. So let the words of the law be burned. Let the words of the law be burned, then delivered to a woman. Did you hear that? Let the words of the law be burned rather than deliver them to a woman. So what did the Talmud say about the Torah and the law when it came to a woman? Don't let her touch it. Something, she'll mess it up, something bad, you know? Here's another one. Talmud, Kiddushim, chapter 82, verse part B. The world cannot exist without males and females. No kidding. Happy is he whose children are males. Woe to him whose children are females. High view of women, low view of women. Women, are you here? Yeah, low view of women. Here's another one. Josephus from the Antiquities, a historian from back in the day of Christ, shortly after Christ. But let not the testimony of women be admitted, like into a court of law, on account of the levity and boldness of their sex, nor let servants be admitted to give testimony on account of the ignobility of their soul, since it's probable that they may not speak the truth. If you allow a woman to testify in court, chances are she's not going to tell the truth. If you're a woman, how do you feel about that? Do you think you could stand in a court of law and tell the truth? Yes. Sure you could. Absolutely you could. And what's Josephus saying? Hey, don't let it happen. Things can go south. The Talmud, Rosh Hashanah, the chapter 1, verse 8, says, any evidence in a court of law which a woman gives is not valid. Wow, it's comforting. Also, they are not valid to offer it. This is equivalent to saying that one who is rabbinical is accounted as a robber is qualified to give the same evidence as a woman. It's like letting a woman, it's telling you, letting a woman testify in a court of law is like letting a criminal testify. You can't trust them. So a scale of 1 to 10, 10 high view of women in Semitic culture, 0 being they need help. Zero. It's funny, all the women said 0. What would the man say? You're saying, I ain't talking. That's like a trick box, you know. I'll give them a 1. I mean, no, 0. Okay. So now with that in mind, I have to build the case, right? So he picks her as the powerful witness. It's a woman. In a culture that men are prized, why in the world did God, on his resurrected day, pick a woman with seven demons that had been excised? Why did he pick her? She's the best possible witness. Chapter 24 of the book of Luke, verse 9, most interesting, says this. And they returned, the women, because they go to the tomb. They find Jesus isn't there, so they come back. They return from the tomb, and they report all these things to the 11 and to all the rest. So they tell the disciples, tomb is empty. Now, that doesn't mean there weren't grave clothes there, because we know there were. So what does that mean, grave clothes? It means they look in the tomb, and what do they see? They see the, because they would wrap a body with cloth and lay spices in between the folds. And once they were done wrapping your body like a mummy, if you're the body, you're not getting out, okay? And they saw that, and it weighed about 100 to 120 pounds. They see a cocoon of where the body was, but there's no body in there. So it leads to the logical question, how'd he get out? How did he get out? Just passed right through him, right? So they see this evidence. So they go and they tell the disciples, hey guys, something's happened. We saw the tomb totally empty. Stone was rolled away. Now, who were these women in verse 10? Now they were Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary, the mother of James. And also other women with them were telling these things to the disciples, probably all at the same time, right? Because guys can just single task. Women can multitask, right? Am I right? Like if I'm playing the piano and Liz wants to talk to me, I'm like, sweetie, I'm not Elton John. It's I play or we talk. I mean, you want Journey? I can play Journey. You want to talk? So they're all talking to the disciples, and notice the response of the disciples. Totally Semitic response. Verse 11. But these words appeared to them. It's what? Nonsense. You hear what these women are saying? Yeah, that the stone was rolled away. Mm-hmm. That the body's gone and it's like a cocoon. Uh-huh. Sure. Yeah, that's just absolutely utter nonsense. So on a scale of 1 to 10, high view of women, 0 low view of women, where are the disciples? 0. The word nonsensical here is the Greek word leros, which means, quote, and I quote from Bauer Anton Gingrich's Greek Lexical Grammar. It's a great book, by the way. They say this word means to be totally devoid of anything worthwhile. Basically, in our culture, what you're telling me is absolutely lame, sweetie. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Okay? So, the Semitic view of the women, scale of 1 to 10, 10 high, 1, 0, not good. How about the Gentiles? Were they any better? Well, not much. Caesar Augustus. Gary Habermas, a New Testament Greek scholar and authority on the resurrection of Christ, says this about Caesar Augustus around the time of Christ. So think about the Gentile view of women. Says that men and women had hitherto always sat together until Caesar Augustus came along. Augustus confined women to the back rows, even at gladiatorial shows, the only ones exempt of this rule being the vestal virgins, from whom separate accommodation was provided, but they had to face the praetor's tribunal. So they could go to the gladiatorial event, but they couldn't face the ring and see all the action. All right? No women at all were allowed to see the witness in the athletic contest. I just went to a Dodger game yesterday. Praise God, they won. Because last time I went, they lost. They went, and I'm sitting there, and I'm surrounded by men and women. And where were the women? Sitting right next to me, looking at the field. In the Roman culture, they wouldn't be allowed to do that. And so they can't see, and so they weren't allowed to see an athletic contest. Indeed, when the audience clamored at the games for a special boxing match to celebrate Caesar's appointment as the chief priest, Augustus postponed this until early the next morning. He issued a proclamation to the effect that it was the chief priest's desire, Augustus, that women should not attend the theater before 10 o'clock. Translated, just let him miss the whole thing. I don't want him there. So, Semitic view of women, scale 1 to 10, probably 0. How about the Gentile view of women? Not any better. And when Jesus wants to validate the fact he's risen from a grave, who's he pick? Doesn't God do things in a different way? Isn't it great that women are here? Because God says, I want to take a woman who had a past, and I redeemed her, and I saved her, and now she's my disciple, and I'm going to appear to her. She's going to be the very first witness of the resurrection, Mary. Says in Mark 16, verse 1, when the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, brought spices so that they might come to anoint him. Very early on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. So they're there at sunrise in the darkness, looking for the tomb, wondering how they're going to move this massive stone with the soldiers there and everything. They are coming to the tomb as skeptics. They're not coming there because they think he's resurrected. They come there bringing more spices to control the odor of his decaying body. It says in verse 5 of Mark 16, entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting to the right, wearing a white robe, and they were amazed. And he said to them, don't be amazed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazarene, who has been crucified. He is risen. He's not here. He's in the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter. Tell him what? Well, that he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you're going to see him, just as he told you. Remember, he told you he was going to rise from the grave. And he'll see you all in Galilee. We don't know exactly what the order of events were of that morning. It's hard to tell from the Gospels because they're giving you different perspectives as to what happened. So if you go to a scene where there's been an accident and you're like a witness and you're giving your account and there's other people, they're probably going to differ a little bit based on their vantage point. And that's what you see when you see the gospel. Some gospels talk about one angel was there. Some of them talk about two angels that were there. I would submit to you, if one author talks about one angel, it doesn't mean there weren't two. He's just talking about one. And so what happened, I think, is the women show up early in the morning. The stone is rolled away. They see the empty tomb, and they go back, all of them in mass, to tell the disciples. The disciples tell them, basically, you're crazy. No way. Then Peter and John say, okay, let's go investigate. So they took off running to go see. Now, Peter and John, one is older, one is younger. Who's the older one? Peter is. John's the younger one. Who goes into the tomb first? John does, because Peter's probably sucking air outside the tomb from having to run over there. You know what I mean? Like over 50 running. It's like, I don't do this anymore. And so where was Mary? Well, I think she followed him back to the tomb. Because it says in John 20, verse 11, after the disciples saw and then went home, she's still outside the tomb. It says in verse 11, but Mary was standing outside the tomb. What was she doing? Weeping. She's weeping. It says, not only is the Lord dead, she can't even see his body anymore. She's weeping. So she wept and she stooped down and she looked into the tomb. And what happened? Well, she saw two angels in white sitting there, one at the head and one at the feet where the body of Jesus has been laying. So between the two angels is the cocoon form of the grave clothes. And she's like, what in the world? And they said to her, woman, why are you weeping? And she said to them, well, because they've taken away my Lord. I mean, I'm looking for his dead body. And I don't know where they have laid him. And so in verse 14, this is most interesting. When she had said this, she turned around and she saw Jesus standing there and she didn't know who he was. Because the last time she saw Jesus, what? He's dead. And it was brutal. She saw, you know, his body was scarred, spear mark, you know, in his side. He was beaten beyond recognition. He was swollen. It was terrible what she saw. And so he's appearing to her in his resurrected body, whole now, and she doesn't recognize him. Have you ever run into anybody and you didn't anticipate running into them? I was on Mount Carmel a couple of years ago, and I went to a seminary with Michael Easley. A lot of people know Michael Easley when he pastored here in town. And I hadn't seen him. This was just a few years ago. I hadn't seen him since 1985. And I was on the top of Mount Carmel, and I took my bus group out and taught them all about the Valley of Armageddon and everything. And then we got back on the bus, and we were just about ready to pull out, and I heard Michael's voice that I hadn't heard since 1985. And I told my wife, I think that's Michael Easley. And so I looked out the bus window, and I'm like, it was Michael Easley. You don't, like, forget the voice, do you? But I wasn't expecting to meet him on the top of Mount Carmel. And so we had a reunion there. This is her, like, I wasn't looking for Jesus, but I ran into him. Jesus said to her, woman, why are you weeping and whom are you seeking? And I love this part after Christ asked her those questions. Who did she think he was? Look, who are you? You're the gardener? You know, gardeners know stuff. Do you know that? I love gardening. I mean, did you garden yesterday? I did all day. It was just glorious. I had a good time. She looks at Jesus and she thinks he's a gardener. And he's probably thinking, this is cute. I mean, she thinks I'm the gardener. And she thinks he's a gardener. She said to him, sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him and I'll take him away. I just want the body of my Lord. And the resurrected Lord is standing like a foot away from her. And then verse 16 happens. What happens? What happened? Jesus said to her, "Hey, Mary." Did she know who he was? Yeah. Because when you know somebody really well and you hear their voice and you're not expecting them, you know the voice, you know? Have you gone to your high school reunion? Have you gone to them? My 50th coming up in June. Scary. I can't believe I've been alive that long. I went to my 20th and I thought everybody had changed then. Now it's like, I don't think I can see this, you know? But even at my 20th, one of my childhood friends came up to me and I didn't even know who it was when I saw him physically, because I hadn't changed, he had. And when he came up and talking to me, and he's like, "Hey, Marty, it's Joe." I'm like, "Joe?" I'm like, "Yeah, Joe Catania." I'm like, "Oh, yeah, Joe, hey, man, you're looking great." Like, "I remember your voice." You know, you remember the voice. I would submit to you that when the Lord calls your name, you're going to go, "Oh, I always knew that was his voice." Because one day he's going to call your name. And then think about it beyond that. One day when you go to heaven and you run into like your mom, like my mom just passed away, or your dad or your brother or your sister or aunt, uncles, friends that went before you, don't you know when you see them in a glorified state, when they're not, old anymore or diseased or what happened to them, they have a glorified body. They might look a little bit improved. But when they come up to you and say, "Hey, Laura, hey, Steve," when they call your name, aren't you going to know the voice? Yeah. She knew who the Lord was. And when she heard his voice, what'd she say? Rabboni means teacher. And then she did something very interesting. She did what you would probably do. Jesus said to her, "Hey, lady, you got to stop clinging to me. I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I ascend to my Father and to your Father and to my God and your God. You got to let me go." What was she doing? She's down on the ground hugging his tunic, you know? Wouldn't you have? And Jesus is like, "Hey, I know you love me. I got other things I got to do. You got to let me go. I got other people I got to see." And then verse 18, Mary Magdalene came and she announced to the disciples. And what did she tell them? You guys that thought I was crazy before, you aren't going to believe this, but I actually have seen the Lord. I talked to him. I held him. I touched him. I'm sure she continued the rest of her life to share her testimony that she saw the risen Lord. You as a believer today are Mary. You are called to share forth the glory of the resurrection of Christ, to tell people, "This man freed me from my sin because he defeated sin and death." The greatest thing you can do is be his witness. That was Mary. So it's test time. Why did he pick her? Number one, she was what? She was a perpetual disciple. Number two, she was a picture of absolute mercy, perfect mercy. Number three, she was the perfect witness, being a woman of great character. Thank God for women of great character. Now might we go out and be Mary. And if you are not a Christian today, I think you have enough evidence to take faith and wed it to the facts that you have, that God has supplied to you, and make a step in faith based on the evidence to embrace Christ as Lord and Savior. Happy Easter to you.